You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, has been diagnosed in a living former professional football player, and then the diagnosis was recently confirmed after his death. We'll find out what that can mean for prevention, detection, and treatment of the controversial condition. First, it's time for a weekly review of state news. This week, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, Republican from here in Wisconsin, announced he's against the GOP tax reform bill in the Senate. He was the first Republican to speak out about against the bill. Here's Johnson talking about why he opposes that legislation on CNN.
And so I'm just looking for a fair shake for all businesses to maintain the competitive balance and position of all businesses. Let's not upset that apple cart and harm our economy.
Robert Menzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau, and he joins us each Friday to talk about the week's biggest news. Rob, welcome back.
Why, thank you.
Well, Senator Johnson spoke out here against this GOP tax overhaul bill. It seemed like that caught a lot of people unaware, didn't it?
Right. Well, Johnson is, it's not the first time that he's done this. It's not the first time this year that he's done this. He's not really a guy who is in with the with Republican leadership, with the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and he positioned himself in the middle of the debate about Obamacare repeal, and said that he wouldn't vote for the Senate's bill when that came out. He did end up voting for it, but he certainly delayed the process and made himself an obstacle there. And now he appears to be sort of assuming a similar position on tax reform.
And he's concerned.
Tax bill.
And he's concerned, as he said, as we heard there, about the effect on not just corporate taxes, but the taxes that affect a lot of other businesses as well. And it's possible this will get negotiated out in the Senate. There's still a long road ahead. Do you see this as a long stand that could delay this in the Senate?
It's odd, to be honest. So Johnson says that the tax bill is too hard on what are called pass-through entities, which is a thing that usually most small businesses use this for technical reasons, and it basically means their business income is taxed like individual income. There are a lot of small businesses that are set up like this, and there are also some very large businesses that are set up like this. And so Johnson's objection, there's something to it. The tax bill, both the House and Senate version of the tax bill, does include these big permanent tax cuts on for corporate taxes, and then the two bills deal with these pass-through businesses either with a much smaller tax cut through deductions, and so it's a much less. It is true what he's diagnosing is correct. There's the bills would widen the gap between the corporate rate and this rate that's paid by these individuals. But what's weird about it is it's a little bit unclear what it is that Johnson is actually asking for. He's talked about the gap being a problem, but it's not clear whether that means that should the corporate tax cuts come down? Should the pass-through tax cuts be increased, which would also increase the deficit? It's a weird situation where, he's a U.S. senator. The Republicans have a fairly narrow majority, and he could hold up this process. He could get together with a couple of other senators and make demands. They would be in a position to make demands, but it doesn't seem like he's inclined to do that. It's just more, he's making himself an obstacle, but it's not clear to what end.
And Republican Representative James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin on a radio show in the state used the phrase strutting like a peacock when talking about Ron Johnson. So some Republicans here in the state not happy with what's coming from Senator Johnson.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, he is making himself an obstacle. There's, the public opinion data, the objective measures that we have say that the Republican tax bill is extremely unpopular. And so as with the attempt to repeal Obamacare, another unpopular piece of legislation, I think that there are many in the Republican Party who see time as the enemy. And that's why this bill isn't getting hearings. It certainly isn't going through the famous regular order of the Senate. And so the idea is to pass it quickly. And if Ron Johnson steps off the bus, if you know one of these other Republican senators does, that becomes harder to do. And it's you know it is possible that dragging out the process in that way imperils the passage of the bill itself.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin about some of the big stories in Wisconsin news. And coming up this weekend now, the start of gun deer season in Wisconsin. There's some hunting news out there, including this will be the first one without the minimum hunting age for mentored hunters. How big a deal is this? This has been talked about a lot for sure, Rob.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, how big a deal is it? We'll see, I suppose. But let's sort of be real about it. Kids could already go hunting and did. You could at 12 get a hunting license and hunt with a gun, but the state already had a mentoring program that allowed kids as young as 10 to go out and hunt with supervision. So now there is no minimum age. And so parents can take their kids at theoretically any age. I don't suppose there'll be. I would hope there wouldn't be a lot of toddlers. But it's probably one of those stories that sort of points to the cultural gap in America between households. In this case, households that hunt and those that don't. It seems to me that probably the people who find it appalling that young kids are going to go out on a hunt are people who on some level maybe don't want to go hunting at all. And for hunting households, it's like it's a generational thing. They see it as, you know, for a long time it would have been a father-son tradition or it would have been seen that way. And today it's more likely to involve mothers and daughters as well. And so from their point of view, like, of course you take the kids out.
And now we've got, on a related note, a hunting season, an open season for groundhogs signed into law this week. What was the pro-con on groundhog hunting?
Yeah, so first of all, like, I want to break the news to listeners that I learned in researching this. I do a lot of preparation for these segments, Rob, and I learned that a woodchuck is the same as a groundhog.
Okay.
And also, according to the Associated Press, they are also called a whistle pig. I feel like the real story is why does this mammal have so many aliases? That is, that's what I want to get to the bottom of. But you're allowed to hunt groundhogs, which seems very challenging to me. Like, I guess wouldn't they be below the ground? But I guess some people trap them, and now at some point in the future, that will be a thing that Wisconsinites can do.
And you can check out Rob's and my new band Whistle Pig at a bar near you this winter. And then finally, Rob, a man in Fond du Lac is selling a historic building. Nothing that unusual there. It's the former Elks Lodge. Here's the weird bit. Not for cash, not for a check, for Bitcoin. Only Bitcoin, this electronic cyber currency. What's the story here, Rob?
Yeah, only Bitcoin. This might be the first time that this has been attempted in Wisconsin. We couldn't find any other instances of this. And our reporter in Fond du Lac, Jillian Ellison, who reported on this for USA Today Network Wisconsin this week. This old building, 1904, historic downtown Fond du Lac building, is up for sale for 40 Bitcoins, or I guess about $260,000. But that's a bit unclear because this Bitcoin is called a cryptocurrency, and it is extremely volatile, and the price sort of goes up and down a bit, so it could be more or less than that on a given day.
And Rob, do you have enough Bitcoins in your collection to afford something like this?
Yeah, I mean, as I understand it, you have to have these, you know, the people who do mining for Bitcoins have these massive computer rigs to work these complex algorithms, and then once they discover, you know, or solve these algorithms, they are able to discover a Bitcoin that has this type of encryption that keeps it from being altered or reproduced, and they're units. But then at that point, I think they're just tulip bulbs, right? I think it's just like a fad that you can invest in this or that. So I'm not going to be buying this building is the short answer.
And I'm going to do the algorithms by hand. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joins us almost every Friday to talk about the week's biggest news. First, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, was first identified nearly 100 years ago, but it's just in the last couple of decades that research has shown a potentially high risk of the condition for people who participate in contact sports like boxing and football. Much of the research that brought this issue to the public attention was done by Dr. Bennett Omalu, the CTE researcher whose work was the subject of the 2015 movie Concussion. Now, new research has been published by a team led by Dr. Omalu that shows that CTE could potentially be diagnosed in living patients. In this case, the patient was Fred McNeil, a former linebacker for the Minnesota Vikings who died in 2015. The diagnosis was confirmed by an autopsy performed after his death. But our next guest says we're still a long way from a reliable method of detecting this condition. Dr. Michael McCrae is a professor of neurosurgery, vice chair of research, and director of brain injury research at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. McCrae, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into this new research, remind us a little bit of what CTE is and what it does to a brain.
So CTE stands for chronic traumatic encephalopathy. It's had a number of labels over the past 100 years or so. I guess most notably it was referred to as dementia pugilistica, a syndrome that was discovered in boxers back in the 1920s. We knew a fair amount about it in boxers through the 1900s, and then more recently there's been a great deal of discussion about an increasing number of autopsy studies in retired or former athletes outside of boxing that have shown evidence of pathological evidence of CTE. It's a neurodegenerative process in select areas of the brain that are oftentimes attributable to the accumulation of a tau protein, which is really a destructive protein in excess causes this neurodegeneration. And in many cases, there's also some contribution of what we refer to as amyloid. Amyloid is the protein that's most often implicated in Alzheimer's disease, and there are a whole assortment of other neurodegenerative diseases or dementias that are associated with tauopathies, or this deposition of tau, as I referred to it a second ago.
And you mentioned that autopsy, and that's been part of the problem, right? That's been the only way we could concretely diagnose CTE is after someone's already dead. Is that right?
That's correct. So CTE is a pathological diagnosis, meaning it's based on brain pathology at autopsy. Just like many brain disorders were in their initial advent or discovery, eventually then diagnostic tools are developed to more effectively but not definitively diagnose the condition in living people. As an example, for instance, Alzheimer's disease is a pathological syndrome. It is diagnosed in living people based on observed clinical characteristics and criteria, but definitively is only diagnosed at autopsy. And the same could be said for CTE, although we lag far behind, obviously, Alzheimer's disease in understanding what, in fact, are the unique clinical characteristics of this disease itself.
And that takes us to this new research. Researchers saying anyway that they've done this scan, they can spot some of those proteins you're talking about. Tell us, first of all, what they presented in this study.
So I was not involved in this study, but basically for your listeners, this is a case of a former NFL football player who was involved in a study a number of years ago where they utilized advanced imaging technologies, positron emission tomography, or what's commonly referred to as PET studies, where they can look at uptake of various ligands in brain tissue and make a better determination as to how those ligands bind to tau or to amyloid, and make interpretations then about the presence of tau or amyloid in the brain. And this gentleman then lived a number of years, and I don't know when exactly he died, but was recently then submitted to autopsy, and in fact, there's pathological evidence of findings consistent with CTE.
So we did this scan, we saw what we thought was evidence of CTE, but we couldn't confirm it until an autopsy, and now, again, researchers are saying, yes, we have confirmed what we initially thought. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
We're talking to Dr. Michael McCray about CTE, this brain condition, and research on trying to spot it when someone is still alive. Now, here's the big question, and I think there's some controversy about this. Does this mean we now have a scan that can detect pathological signs of CTE while someone is still alive?
No, it does not. And you're right. There is a great deal of controversy. This is a start. This is a single case. But most of the scientific community in Alzheimer's disease will tell you, for instance, that we've had a number of breakthroughs, what were thought to be really groundbreaking developments in diagnostic studies for Alzheimer's disease that then eventually did not pan out. Developing any kind of a diagnostic test, obviously we're first and foremost interested in maximizing what we call sensitivity, that what is the slightest signal of this disease that our device is able to detect and do it as early as possible and in the mildest form, right? So that we're chasing maximum sensitivity of a diagnostic test, whatever that might be, a blood test, an imaging tool, or otherwise. But the other side of the equation is what we call specificity, meaning that signal that I find, is it in fact specific to disease entity A, or is this signal something that I find very sensitively in mild form, but then in the end I discover that it's evident across a whole host of disorders, diseases, or conditions even in normal people? And in most cases where diagnostic studies struggle or eventually fail is on the specificity side. In fact, they turn out not to be a unique marker for a single disease, but they're prevalent across a whole host of conditions or in normal living people without disease at all, and they prove not to be very accurate diagnostically. It remains to be seen how this tool will play out in future studies.
Right. You mentioned some of the same proteins we might see in CTE are ones that might be associated with something like Alzheimer's. So even if we can detect them, we don't know if this is a condition related to repeated head injury or something completely unrelated.
That is correct. And just within the category of what I mentioned, tauopathies or brain diseases that are known to be caused by excessive tau deposition, there's somewhere in the order of 50 tauopathies. And there are scientists around the world who dedicate their laboratories to the study of these tauopathies. And even those are difficult to differentiate diagnostically.
Even if we could reliably detect CTE, and it sounds like that would be a long way off, do we know anything about treatment if we do know that somebody has this while they're still alive?
We know little or nothing about treatment to this point. And I'll add this to complicate matters even further, but at a much more foundational level, we know very little about the incidence of this disease entity, CTE, in retired or former athletes or in the general population. So there's a lot of debate out there as to this association between exposure to prior concussion or repetitive head impacts in sports or other activities and the eventual risk of CTE. One thing is for certain, and I'd be remiss if I didn't make this comment. Really, is that there have been media stories in the last several months, most famously over the summer, where a research publication was presented in the lay press, indicating that 110 out of 111 brains of former NFL players were found to be CTE positive on autopsy. And my concern there is that people like you and I, who are the parents of young kids who are active in all sorts of athletic activities and athletes themselves, for instance, they are at great likelihood of jumping to the conclusion that, for instance, there's a 99% chance of getting CTE, which is just, in my mind, highly irresponsible and reckless. So I think we need to bring some context to this discussion. And the burning questions scientifically really are, what are the true population-based risks? You know, there was a study, for instance, published at the same time this summer indicating that former high school football players right here in the state of Wisconsin were, in fact, at no greater risk of cognitive decline or late-life neurodegenerative disease compared to their counterparts who did not play high school football. So we need to understand, what are the true population-based risks of CTE or late-life neurologic health problems in athletes or non-athletes? And for me, the burning question is, in that small group, that very small percentage of individuals that may be affected, why them? Why is it that an individual is at heightened risk of late-life neurologic health problems when there are literally thousands of individuals that have similar histories who go on to lead completely normal and healthy lifestyles for, you know, a normal life duration?
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. McRae, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Michael McRae is a professor of neurosurgery, vice chair of research, and director of brain injury research at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He was with us to explain the significance of a medical paper on the diagnosis of CTE in a living patient. First, after more than a year in the making, the City of Milwaukee's Office of Violence Prevention released today its long-awaited Blueprint for Peace report. It lays out comprehensive goals and strategies for preventing and reducing violence in the city. Milwaukee has already seen over 100 homicides so far in 2017, according to data compiled by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and the city's homicide rate has increased sharply in recent years. In response, the Blueprint for Peace report lays out six larger goals to prevent violence, things like fostering safe neighborhoods and supporting kids, with further specific strategies to try and achieve each goal. Reggie Moore joins us now to take a closer look at the report. He's director of the City of Milwaukee Health Department's Office of Violence Prevention. Reggie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with a bit of background on the effort that led to this report. What got this this effort on the ground in the first place?
I think starting a little bit even before the planning process, I think after the spike in homicides in 2015, there was, you know, obviously a cause for alarm with the even around the country with the level of shootings and homicides that had increased. And so I think the mayor, you know, had a commitment to really looking at how do we galvanize the community to develop a more comprehensive approach to public safety. And he started by actually investing in the Office of Violence Prevention and expanding and strengthening that office within the health department to take on this issue. I think the first mandate was, basically launching the planning process to develop the blueprint for peace.
We'll get into specifics later on, but big picture, what was the overall goal when you started off this process?
I think the overall goal was to center the voices of those who've been directly impacted by this issue. I think, you know, far too often, city leaders or, you know, other folks get in a room in a huddle with about 5 or 10 folks and come up with plans, for the community. This was a completely different process than that. This really was an effort to center the community, to engage the community, and to say what are the things that we believe are driving, you know, violence in the city and that we should be doing to increase protective and resilience factors to basically prevent violence, and then what are some things we should be doing to decrease risk factors in terms of people's exposure to violence.
And with that in mind, who was at the table who contributed to the report?
Right. So basically the way the structure worked is we had a steering committee of about 30 individuals that included a broad cross-section of philanthropic, business, community, youth, nonprofit, various in terms of different parts of the city. So Children's Hospital, the NAACP, the Spanish Center of Milwaukee, Greater Milwaukee Foundation, Pathfinders, Chief of Police, a very broad cross-section of individuals who are on the steering committee, including the mayor, County Executive Abley, and President Ashanti Hamilton. And really their role was to hold the process accountable for centering the voices of the community in this process.
Now, violence, of course, is a law enforcement issue in one way, but you took a public health approach in this report as well. What would that mean in this case?
It really means means looking at it and understanding clearly what are the things that are driving, you know, violence. And if you think about it, even like a communicable disease or epidemic, which, you know, violence, unfortunately, in our country is, you know, where is it happening? How is it being transmitted? What are the things that are actually driving transmission? And one of the things that we note in Milwaukee, just looking at homicide and non-fatal shooting data, a lot of our violence is conflict-driven. And it's obviously, you know, tends to be folks who are in social proximity to each other. So it's very rare that people are, you know, aside from the carjacking issue, are becoming victimized randomly in terms of random acts, particularly when it results in homicide. And so when we understand that, then we start to say, you know, with the blueprint, we identify 10 priority neighborhoods. And those are neighborhoods were identified based on three-year trends in terms of combined aggravated assaults, non-fatal shootings, and homicides. And so a public health approach looks at that, looks at what's driving the transmission, identifies interventions that could work. The interventions that do work, we look at how do we scale them. So we think about it like a vaccine, and you think about a violence prevention approach. It's really pre-event. So how do we actually, you know, vaccinate our community against violence? And obviously that starts young, but it also has to continue throughout adulthood. And so violence is a learned behavior, and it's something that can be unlearned. And so that's really what a public health approach entails.
And Reggie, you've mentioned different kinds of violence there. The ones that have gotten the headlines a lot of times in Milwaukee are the homicide numbers, the shootings, and the carjackings. But this report also looks at things like domestic violence. It's not just the stuff that's in the headlines.
Absolutely, yes. And one of the things, and we had a lot of support from the Prevention Institute. So if your listeners are looking for more information to sort of understand, you know, what this approach looks like on a national level, the Prevention Institute is a leader in this work and has helped many cities with these types of plans. But, you know, really looking at how do we, you know, focus on where violence is happening and how do we, you know, how do we address it and not, you know, just episodically, but how do we address it for the long term? And when it comes to an issue like domestic violence, understanding that a child who is exposed to violence by seeing that happen in their home is more likely to actually either commit acts of violence or they themselves be victimized by violence by the sheer fact of witnessing it.
We're talking to Reggie Moore. He's with the City of Milwaukee Health Department's Office of Violence Prevention, looking at a new report, Blueprint for Peace, aimed at preventing violence in Milwaukee. And there are six goals and sub-strategies within those. I want to go through at least some of those, Reggie. And the first one is captioned, Stop the Shooting, Stop the Violence. So what goes into that?
Right. And so the way for those that may download or see a copy of the blueprint, they're not necessarily in priority order. So I want people to understand that first. But really what that looks at is how do we, you know, one, respond pre-incident, during the incident, and post-incident. And understanding that oftentimes if there's a shooting or a homicide, there's a law enforcement response, but there also has to be a violence interruption response. And that's why in terms of the ceasefire strategy that, you know, the mayor has put support behind and that we're also looking to gain private support for is really looking at how do we engage with folks who have been shot. And so we know that someone who's been shot is almost 10 times more likely to engage in violence in one way or another, but particularly in the short term and retaliatory violence. So expanding work like what Project Ujima is doing with young people and adults, looking at how do we take that to the street and how do we engage with individuals who are, you know, sort of, you know, we can almost, I'm going to say predict is a strong word, but we can, you know, just based on their experiences, based on the fact that if they've been victimized by violence and the types of social networks that they're around, those are priority individuals that we want to get to and help, you know, if we can get them on a different path in terms of making, you know, different decisions and engaging in a lifestyle that's less lethal, that is what the violence interruption model looks to do. The other piece is looking at crisis intervention. And so working with, you know, law enforcement and also working with domestic violence agencies and looking at domestic violence prevention agencies and looking at lethality assessments, for example, is that there's, you know, incidents that you can look at in terms of and right now if a victim has actually been choked. Like choking is actually a high indicator for that relationship resulting in a lethal homicide. And so when a victim, you know, calls for support or service or law enforcement responds to that incident, you know, there's an assessment done in terms of what has been the history of violence in this particular relationship. And if there's certain things that are present, those types of assessments help prioritize the response to those issues. And the other piece, and we've, you know, engaged a lot of families who've experienced trauma as a result of violence, particularly Ramona, who is Leah Jenkins' auntie, and Devin Cameron, who lost a child to gun violence, was on the steering committee. And one of the things that they've talked deeply about is, one, access to counseling post-incident. I know there's some limited counseling through the state and through the county, but that is something that they want to see ongoing in the community, and particularly also with children who have witnessed violence. And so I can talk a little bit later about our trauma response initiative, but those are some examples of things that were strategies in terms of reducing particularly gun violence. And I'll be remiss to also not mention the work that WAVE is doing around decreasing illegal gun availability and access, because we also know that, unfortunately, there are individuals who are prohibited from carrying firearms who choose to do it, either based on where they are or the type of lifestyle that they're living. And the more that we can actually get those guns and restrict access to folks who are, you know, legally prohibited from having firearms, the better.
And then another one of the goals was promote healing and restorative justice. Can you talk about that?
Right. One of the quotes that a youth planning focus group member actually spoke to that was relevant to that goal is, we need places to address trauma and respond to community anger. I think when we think about what happened last summer with Sherman Park, I think is a reflection of that. There's a lot of unhealed, you know, pain and trauma, both from interpersonal violence, but also from structural and systemic violence, where when we talk about or define what justice looks like, you know, it's really hard to engage in healing without justice. And we see the two going hand in hand. And so when we talk about, you know, both, and that's why the goal is labeled promote healing and restorative justice. Every label and every term in this document is very intentional. And the steering committee, you know, dealt with these things very deeply in terms of how we define these goals and strategies. And so this, in this particular area, it's really about expanding access to trauma-informed care and counseling. And so with our trauma response initiative, we partner with Milwaukee Police Department and Milwaukee County Behavioral Health in districts 5 and 7, that when law enforcement responds to an incident where a child has either been victimized or witnessed violence, we provide counseling to that family within 72 hours. We're actually about to expand that to the fire department and train all of the EMTs and also firefighters in trauma response, so that they're also another trusted source of referral for this program. The other piece is looking at, when we look at the opioid crisis in our community as well, a lot of that is also driven by untreated trauma and stress and other issues that cause dependency. So really also looking at that connection, not dismissing the role and the power of faith and spirituality and cultural traditions as also a modality of building resilience and healing. And so those are some of the strategies that are highlighted in the blueprint.
We're talking to Reggie Moore, director of the City of Milwaukee Health Department's Office of Violence Prevention. They just released a new report called Blueprint for Peace. The report outlines strategies to prevent and reduce violence in the city. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What steps do you think can be taken to reduce violence in Milwaukee, or if you're not in Milwaukee, in your own community? Do you like this idea of focusing on violence prevention? Whose responsibility is it to prevent and reduce violence? City leaders, community groups, individuals? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or if you have a question for our guest, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Reggie Moore, director of the City of Milwaukee Health Department's Office of Violence Prevention, talking about the new report, Blueprint for Peace, aimed at reducing violence in the city. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're in Milwaukee yourself, what are your thoughts on crime and violence, various forms of violence in your community? What do you think needs to change? If you are anywhere in the state, call in with your questions for our guest, or maybe an intervention, something that's worked in your own community to improve things. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Reggie, before we get back to the details of the report, how do you make sure that this isn't, you know, a series of kind of bureaucratic recommendations that doesn't really get the community on board and involved in all this?
Yeah, I think that's actually an easy question. I think the way we've done that is by starting with the community. So when we launched the process, we started with 150 community members in a room and really grappling with and having very honest conversations. I mean, you have young men who've had experiences, you know, with law enforcement, folks who have been shot, you know, just through interpersonal violence. You had the DA there, you had law enforcement, you had, you know, the business community. And it was a really raw and honest dialogue about various people's experiences with violence in the city at various levels. And, you know, we were able to move from that, and when I say move from that, acknowledging it and being honest with each other about it and not, you know, passing it off as, you know, people's lived experience with violence, and honoring that and making a commitment to each other that this is something that is intolerable and that we have to reduce, because, you know, living is a human right and people should be able to live in safety, regardless of what area of the city that you live in. And we know that violence impacts, you know, different areas of the city differently. And so acknowledging that, and then also identifying based on those experiences, what do we feel are the greatest risk factors that expose or increase exposure to violence? And what are the protective factors and things that we should be doing to inoculate against it? And so the community was a part of defining those things. And throughout the process, all of the goals and strategies and recommendations in here were fed through a process of the community identifying, the steering committee synthesizing, kicking it back to the community to validate. And then ultimately, the last validation was also looking at, you know, research or evidence that would back that particular strategy. And that's how things were identified in the blueprint. So it's a very intense process of community input, but then also making sure that the strategies and the recommendations were evidence-informed.
Getting back to the goals in the report, one of them is to promote economic opportunity. Sounds maybe easier said than done, but what kind of things do you have in mind?
Absolutely. I mean, the things that are called for in the blueprint, you know, one is looking at, you know, connecting adults to employment opportunities with a living wage and removing accessibility barriers. So, you know, some of the specific strategies around that is, you know, to adopt local policies to support a living wage and local hiring, to adopt policies to support paid sick leave, paternity and maternity leave, build on and tailor and expand workforce and employment development efforts that link job seekers to the greatest need to open positions. So when we look at a Foxconn, when we look at Amazon and where, you know, a lot of these jobs are being built, we also have to look at transportation. And it's interesting, I've talked to, you know, several public officials who have a deep, you know, concern and passion about transit and transportation. And so getting them to understand that transit is a public, you know, safety issue as well. And so understanding that, you know, when we look at especially property crimes or robbery, sometimes those things are, or oftentimes actually, they're driven by economic need. And so, you know, ensuring that people who need access to employment are able to get that, particularly individuals who are maybe returning from incarceration and have a harder time finding employment than others. If we want them to live a different lifestyle and pursue a different way, we have to make sure they have access to the resources. We have to remove every excuse, and we have to remove every barrier to ensure that people who want to change and actually, you know, do the right thing have access to do that. And unfortunately, historically, we have not had that.
And then another goal moving through those is to support children, youth, and families. And there's obviously overlap with some of the other things you've talked about, but specifically, what does the report look at?
Yeah, and this is a big one because this encompasses everything from youth development, after school programs, looking at domestic violence, looking at child abuse and neglect reduction, and so. The way that it's, you know, some of the things that it calls for is really looking at ensuring that there are safe and accessible community spaces, you know, in particularly the priority neighborhoods, but throughout the city, ensuring that, you know, transportation routes are safe. When we surveyed over 1,000 people and asked them what areas of the city least safe in, it was actually walking around the city. And we know in talking with young people, a lot of that is driven by their fear of assault, particularly for the young women, and harassment, as well as armed robbery. And so when we think about also our public spaces like parks, where, you know, there are parents who may be afraid to allow their children to walk by themselves. I used to wander the city quite a bit as a child. As a parent now, I look back and like, how did I get away with that? But, you know, in terms of it should be safe that you, you know, can trust your 12 or 13-year-old to be able to walk to the store or walk, you know, 5 to 10 blocks away even to the park. You know, and that is a public health issue in the sense that when we talk about kids being able to be outside and play, and, you know, we talk about obesity and health and nutrition, all of those things are impacted when the community doesn't feel safe. And so, you know, economic development, really looking at the built environment and how do we make sure that we address and eliminate blight in neighborhoods, because those things often become nuisance properties. You know, Alderman Murphy actually led an effort called MTA Plays. And so really revamping and revitalizing a lot of the city playgrounds and parks, you know, is a strategy that's reflective of that.
We're talking to Reggie Moore with the Office of Violence Prevention in Milwaukee. Their new report is Blueprint for Peace, looking at ways to reduce and prevent violence in the city. And Reggie, a big one is to strengthen the capacity and coordination of violence prevention efforts. I know there are groups in Milwaukee that work to prevent violence. We've talked to some of them on the show before. What kind of violence prevention efforts could use more support there?
All of them is the short answer. I think there's a lot of fragmentation. I think there's a lot of good-hearted people who wake up and they recognize enough is enough, and they roll up their sleeves and they do what they have to do. But at the same time, we want people to do that, but also we want to be able to make sure that they have the capacity to do that to the scale that's needed. And so if, you know, oftentimes you'll have five people with the same idea, for example, patrolling, you know, neighborhoods. And if we can get them together and say, okay, how do we actually pool our resources? If we need to actually buy cars, you know, in terms of people driving around and doing sort of block watch type activities, or if people want to do block parties, how do we, you know, how as a health department, how can we support that through resources where there's grills that we can actually pool and take, you know, to a location as opposed to everybody trying to raise money to buy all the materials and supplies that they need. I think Heal the Hood was a prime example of that this summer, where they went from one block party event to four, and we were able to sponsor that. And when we look at the data pre, during, and post those events, because some people may say, well, what does a block party have to do with violence? We actually saw reductions in shooting, non-fatal shootings and homicides in many of those areas, because they were targeted in areas that have had significant incidents of trauma and violence. And so community engagement, which was an example of that, being led by a community member, this wasn't a nonprofit or anything like that, can have an impact. And so, you know, that's on the grassroots level. But then even when we go up to sort of the larger institutions, whether it be nonprofits, hospital systems, and others who are providing violence prevention programming, there has to be a bridge built. And there also has to be a level of accountability in terms of how resources are allocated, how do we use those resources, and how do we track our impact in terms of communicating the work that's happening, the impact that it's having, and being supportive of each other to have the greatest.
And Reggie, just briefly, we're just about out of time, but sometimes from the outside, when we look at a city dealing with crime problems, people think there's despair, there's hopelessness. As you go through this process, do you see hope?
Absolutely. And I think the mayor hit it on the head, you know, today at the press conference, where he said, this is doable. And we know from a public health approach that violence is preventable. And so I am very optimistic and hopeful about this. I don't think I would have taken on this role. I don't think the health department would have engaged in this process. And so I think there's a significant amount of hope within the city for making this happen, and quite frankly, also in the community. But again, the plan will only work if we work it.
Reggie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Reggie Moore, director of the City of Milwaukee Health Department's Office of Violence Prevention. We've been talking about a new report they just released. It's called Blueprint for Peace.